Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air, Heritage Radio Network, and the program is The Naturalist. And I just heard that great commercial about Fairway. That was really nice. So today, my co-host is here with us today, Carol Butler. Carol, say hi to everybody.
Hello, glad to be back.
And the show today is going to be on raptors. And I'm not going to say anything else for a minute, and I'll let Carol introduce the subject of raptors, and then we'll have sort of a dialogue discussion. And if you folks have any questions at all about raptors, or if you've had any experiences with them, you can put a comment right on the site. There's a place for comments, and we would love to have comments. So, Carol, let's get started about what is a raptor to start off
with. The reason I'm talking about raptors is that my latest book called How Fast Can a Raptor Dive just came out. We got the first copies last week. And this is written with Peter Capagnolo, who is an ornithologist and a falconer, an ornithologist at the Museum of Natural History, where Bernie and I work in the Butterfly Conservatory. And Peter's also a falconer, so we have wonderful stories about falconry in the book, as well as lots of information about raptors and their lives and their biology, their behavior, all the things that we have in the other books in the series. I just want to comment, Bernie, this weekend I was at the wetlands at Stone Harbor, New Jersey, which is a beautiful place. I highly recommend it. It's the second year I've been invited there to sign books, and lovely people. And while I had a table set up with all the books, there are five in the series now, down there, everybody who stopped at the table had hummingbirds coming to their yard. Mm.
Yeah, we're on the flyway for hummingbirds.
Well, they've been there for a while. One person said mm-hmm. they had gone, and we said maybe they migrated, but every other person still had them this weekend.
So do they stay there all summer?
I imagine that they migrate. Yes, those folks are there for the summer, and then they migrate as well.
The folks or the birds?
The folks migrate, and the birds migrate.
Okay.
But it was just interesting that there was, I didn't expect that.
Right.
We sold out all the hummingbird books, and nobody was particularly interested in the raptor book, because they're all very caught up with hummingbirds.
Yeah, so they must have hummingbird feeders in there.
Everybody had feeders. Places, woman said she just had plants that attracted them, but everybody else had feeders. But it's just interesting to know that there are so many hummingbird sites in that area. Because my mm-hmm. experience with hummingbirds is all out in Arizona, and out on the West Coast and Mexico, of course, where they're very plentiful.
Right here in the city, if you put out a feeder, you'll get hummingbirds also.
I have heard that. Yes. Even in Central Park.
In Central Park, you can see hummers. Certainly during the spring migration mm-hmm. and the fall migration. I don't know for sure if they stick around all summer in the park, but I know the only one we really get is the ruby-throated green hummingbird.
Right.
And that's the folks down there, probably that's the same one that they get, because it's the only one that we regularly see in the East Coast, as I recall.
So just sort of a hummingbird aside. But now we'll talk about
aside.
Raptors.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So there's a lot about raptors, and we're going to do a couple of more shows with Peter Campagnolo in a few weeks that you will hear. And I posted some wonderful photographs on the website of some of the raptors that we included in the book. We got beautiful photographs from Richard Ettlinger, who had a show at the museum of his bird photographs.
Those were spectacular photographs. Yeah, wow.
And he gave us two zip files to use as we wish. So we only wish we had more color pages and a bigger book, because we would have certainly used more. Okay, so what is a raptor? Raptors are birds of prey that prey on animals that they either catch and kill themselves or find injured or already dead, right? However, when you start thinking about that, there are other birds that feed on living organisms. Pelicans eat fish. Robins eat worms. And so the distinction is very specific to what makes a bird a raptor and not... And a bird that eats live animals, not a raptor.
Right.
It's a little strange.
Yeah, most birds eat bugs.
Right.
As part of their diet, yeah.
So, but raptors seize prey. There are some raptors that eat insects, but I don't think that, maybe for some, it's their basic prey, for some really small raptors.
Yeah, like kestrels.
Right.
Yeah.
But raptors basically seize prey with their talons, either snatching fish from the water or striking birds out of the air or pouncing on the ground on quarries like reptiles or amphibians and insects.
So raptors, the physical structure of a raptor is quite different than like a passerine, like a songbirds or other birds, right?
Right. It really refers to five or seven families, depending on your school of thought, of flesh-eating birds that include eagles, hawks, falcons, ospreys, vultures, and we include owls, which I'll talk about, but they sort of have co-evolved. Everybody doesn't include owls. And there's also some people don't include vultures. So the word raptor is also applied to the ancestors of modern birds. Right, carnivorous extinct dinosaurs such as Velociraptor, which we all remember from Jurassic Park, except they're much smaller. And I'll talk about that too, the connection between raptor dinosaurs and modern birds of prey, which is interesting.
Yeah, I looked up the definition of the word raptor. There's the word rapers in it. It's taking something forcibly against the individual's will.
That's right. It's from the Latin raptator, which means to rob, and raptore, which means to seize and carry away.
Right.
Very good. You did your homework.
Yep.
Let me comment about owls, because it's interesting that they're controversial. And I went with Paul Keim, who is an owl expert, into Pelham Bay Park. And we found, I mean, who would dream that there are owls in Pelham Bay Park? I have a photograph in the book of a little saw-whet owl that I was able to photograph.
How big is it when you say little?
I'm showing you.
Yeah, I know, but you have to tell the folks out here.
I don't know. Very small.
Small.
10 inches, something like that.
Okay.
And they have markings on them, and they stay very high in the trees, so they're really hard to see. You know that there are owls, which I learned, I give Paul credit for this. You look at the base of the tree for what they call whitewash, which is the waste material. It's like seagulls make on a boat. We had a little boat, and you always got that white stuff.
Right.
When you see a lot of whitewash at the base of a tree, it suggests that there might be or have been an owl in that tree. But then you usually can't see the owl, even with binoculars, because they stay so high up and they're very camouflaged.
Yeah, what about pellets? Do you find the pellets too?
Yes, also pellets.
You want to tell people what pellets are?
We have a picture of a pellet that somebody in the museum found on his windowsill at the museum. Ellison, his name is. A pellet, when an owl eats his or her live prey, they swallow it whole. And then as they digest it, the bones and feathers and waste material gets compressed, and that at a certain point they regurgitate it, and they don't vomit, but they just do, they just have kind of a spasm, and they, it's not exactly a cough, but they, let's say, they cough up this compressed pellet, which has all the undigestible parts of the prey. And those are also indications that owls are around. The problem is that pellets get broken up sometimes. So in where we were, or they could get stepped on, mm-hmm. you know, we didn't see a lot of pellets. We did see some, but the whitewash is a good sign. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I have a photograph of a saw-whet owl in the book that was, I was very thrilled because it was so hard to see them. And I took a million photographs and it was hard to really get one where you could see the owl.
Yes, he's very well camouflaged in your photo
yes.
too. I saw
yeah,
that
exactly.
one in the book.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so owls share the characteristics of raptors, but they are not, they share some of the characteristics, but they're not closely related to eagles, kites, or hawks. Their relationship is described as convergent evolution, mm-hmm. which means animals related to one another have evolved similar traits to in order to adapt to similar environmental challenges. So according to Peter's point of view of the existing scientific norm, we're including owls under the broad definition of birds of prey. I should add, there are approximately 500 species of birds of prey that are considered raptors. Over 300 hunt during the day, diurnal is the way we describe that, and the others hunt at night, nocturnal. And at dusk and dawn, there are times when both types of birds may be active. Most owls we think of as nocturnal, but there are some, like northern hawk owls, that do hunt during the day.
Hmm.
Okay, so that's
that covers sort of the definition
sort of the
of
basics right.
of what a raptor is, and we're going to include the owls because I think they should be there because they hunt the same way that the other raptors hunt.
Now I'll talk a little bit. I have so many different areas that I would like to talk about, but I do want to mention we have a wonderful sidebar in the book by Alan Turner, who's also from the Museum of Natural History, who as part of his dissertation discovered the feather quill knobs on a specimen of Velociraptor he was studying as part of his dissertation work.
So this is one of the ancient relatives of our present-day raptors, the Velociraptor,
right,
which was a real critter.
Right, but they were very small. They were like 7 pounds.
Right. In the movie, they made them quite big, like
right.
a couple of feet.
You know what we forgot was water.
Oh, okay.
Well, maybe Jack can find a little water for us in between segments. otherwise, I'll be coughing. Okay, so that's we do have a very interesting sidebar written by Alan, very kindly contributed to the book, about his discovery of the feather quill knobs, which sort of was one more confirmation of the relationship between birds of prey and dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm. So what do these look like, these feather quill knobs?
Well, there were, well, we have photographs of them, little bumps on the bones, which is the place where the feathers were attached to the
to
bone.
The bone. Uh-huh. Okay.
We have a whole bunch of illustrations that Alan gave us.
That's Carol's new book on raptors that she keeps referring to.
How fast can a falcon
dive? I spent about an hour glancing through it the other night, and it's another terrific addition to the series in the question and answer format that Carol has done with other people, and she did this one with Peter, who's an ornithologist at the museum, so she has a lot of good information in it. And it in this format, it's a great family book.
Absolutely.
Because kids always ask questions and about birds and other stuff, and here you are. You have all this great information, and they're not expensive books. They can be a great addition to your library. They're soft cover, but they even put in some beautiful color photos of birds.
Thank you for the commercial. That's wonderful.
Certainly.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
Okay, quickly about the dinosaurs, just to get that in, because we did mention it.
Sure.
About 80 million years ago, there was a discovery in Argentina of a dinosaur fossil, and the dinosaur clearly had a hooked claw on each hind foot that appears to be used to disembowel prey. And that claw is a distinctive feature of this family of dinosaurs that are also called running lizards, and that's the group that includes the Velociraptor. And they ranged in size. And the discovery, there were microraptor. These are really small raptors. They weigh only a few pounds. Their fossils were discovered in China, and they revealed more clearly that feathered species exist. And this really revolutionized paleontologists' ideas about how these creatures looked, and caused a big revision in the drawings. I had on my computer, on my desktop, a picture that we recently got of a feathered
early dinosaur,
theropod dinosaur, because somebody recently discovered the pigment in the fossil that would suggest the color of the feathers.
Ah, yes.
So that one was black and white, and they actually had the pattern recreated from the little data that they got from the fossils.
Yeah, I know. We have cast in the museum of the feathered dinosaur,
right.
And that was a big thing probably about 8-9 years ago, right, or something like that, when they first found that. And the other thing that made them know that they were birds was they found eggs,
right,
and a nest,
that's right,
of these feathered ancestors of the birds.
They had air filled bones and they laid eggs, and they also had feet that were similarly formed to birds.
Right, like the talons and that
right.
stuff. Okay, so we're gonna sign off for a minute and give Carol a drink of water, and then we'll be back on the air for the next segment of this great story about raptors. Hi, this is Bernie Wise and Carol Butler back on the air again, Heritage Radio Network, and the program is The Naturalist, and we're discussing today this terrific topic of raptors, and you all now know what a raptor is. It's a bird that is made as a killing machine, really, most of the time flying. It has talons on its feet for grabbing prey, and it has usually a hooked beak for ripping apart and dismembering its food. And I'll just tell you one quick experience that I saw in Central Park. You know, our famous hawk in Central Park,
pale male.
We'll talk about that later on. But I once was walking behind the Metropolitan Museum, and for some reason, I always do this, I looked up at the roof line, and there was a pale male, the hawk, sitting on the roof line, and there were pigeons feeding right next to me on the sidewalk. And one of the prime preys of the this raptor, this pale male, are pigeons and rats. So even while I was standing there, he swooped down, grabbed the pigeon in his talons, flew back up to the peak of the roof of the Metropolitan, and started pulling the feathers off and pulling them apart so he could get to the meat. Wow. So that was really fascinating to see.
Wow.
In the middle of New York City,
right, exactly.
His wildlife, and it's really wildlife to see that. So we'll talk more about pale male as we go on, but we'll get back to the story, Carol.
We can talk about that. I just talk about wildlife. I was working on this book with Peter late one evening at the museum, and I left out the front exit walking to the subway, and as I walked along the museum side of Central Park West, two enormous raccoons crossed over from the park, just like pedestrians. They just crossed Central Park West, walked right in front of me into the museum grounds. They were huge. I was completely stunned. I immediately called Peter up and said, "You can't believe it."
Did they wait for the light to change?
The light was green.
I think they know that already.
They're very acclimated. We should talk about pale male. Pale Male, you all know, there are videos and there's been a lot of articles. Even if you don't live in New York, he's a famous hawk.
Right, red tail.
Red-tailed hawk that lives on a building in Fifth Avenue. And what is interesting, Bernie took me in Central Park one day to meet people who live their lives centered around Pale Male. Now, if you saw, there's a video that Bernie lent me.
It's a terrific video.
Where you see this crowd of people every day with looking for Pale Male and wanting to see whether, if they've mated, whether they have chicks. But tell about the fellows who stay by the boat pond.
Yes, there's one fellow particularly. His name is Rick. He's a very pleasant guy. He's a great photographer. And he's there every day. Summer, winter, doesn't make a difference. Of course, the best time to look for Pale Male is when they're on the nest, which is right across Fifth Avenue from the boat pond. If you don't know Central Park too well, just ask somebody where the sailboat pond is. The official name of that water is called the Conservancy Pond.
Okay.
But everybody calls it the sailboat pond because you can, believe it or not, you can rent radio-controlled sailboats there and sail them around the pond, and you can be a captain for a while.
Yes, that's right.
And you can even call out commands like coming about and things like that. But it's really fun. A lot of people love to do it. It's not that expensive. And on the east side of the pond is the bench, as it's called, where people come and they want to see what's going on with Pale Male. So even that this year, the nest is the female laid eggs, and but the eggs were not viable. They didn't hatch out. And they don't know why. It may be because Pale Male is getting kind of old. He's been doing this for about, 20 years. About
with a series of different
mates, because right. The females have died for various reasons. I think one got hit by a car, one was killed by rat poison that they put in the park, and other reasons.
Urban
and
raptors.
I think he's had 25 offspring, who have now started their own nests all around the city. So if you see a red-tailed hawk in the park, I know we have one now in Riverside Drive. It's a descendant of Pale Male.
But you should these guys. There are a couple of them sit on this bench,
right,
and they have an enormous telescope,
right, spotting scope
that is aimed in fixed position, aimed at the nest, and anybody who walks by is welcome to look through the scope, and you see the nest and you see what they're doing, and they're watching them all day. When we were there, they said, oh yes, he was just on the nest, now he's over there. They're completely engrossed with these birds all day, and they also have some photographs to sell
yes.
that they've taken. Obviously, I don't know how they live, but this is what they do. It's absolutely fascinating. If you're ever in Central Park, you really should go to the bench next to the boat pond and chat with these guys and take a look through the scope and see the nest. And there's all kinds of information about Pale Male online that you can. It's easy to find out the story if you don't know it, but it's really fun to see this.
And if you're really intrigued by this story, by the way, it's called Pale Male because he's a red-tailed hawk, and his coloration wasn't as bright or as red as an average red-tailed hawk. That's why he got the name Pale Male. And if you're really interested in it, you can go to the gift shop in Central Park and get the two videos that were made about Pale Male. The first one was showing him raising his family. And then the second video, I won't tell you much about it, but he's living in a co-op, and the co-op board decided that they didn't want him to live in their co-op anymore, because what was happening, since the nest is over one of the windows, when he would bring prey back to his partner who was sitting on the eggs, or they take turns doing this, and they would start ripping apart a rat or something, some of it was dropping down onto the sidewalk in front of their building. So, of course, these people are very wealthy. And, Mary Tyler Moore lives in that building.
That's right.
And she was a heroine.
She was on the side of the Pale Male.
In the second part of the story. So very quickly, they wanted to remove the nest. And it became a really international incident. And I won't tell you what happened, because if you want to find out, get the second video that was made. And it tells the whole story of the bird being evicted from the nest and the political stuff. It became a worldwide phenomenon.
Right. And it also gives you an insight into, I don't want to say the fringe, because I don't mean it in a pejorative way, but even though we live in the city, There are so many people who are really passionate about animals, and you really see how far people will go to not lose an animal that's been living in the city for a long time.
Right.
And how protective they are and how militant they are. It's really interesting.
Absolutely, because, you know, you're not supposed to feed wildlife in the park.
Right.
But people feed the pigeons all the time. And, you know, we have so many pigeons that you really shouldn't do it, okay? When you're feeding the pigeons, you're feeding the rats also, because, you know, there are rats in the city. We don't like to talk about them, but they are there. And once I went to a little meeting of pigeon lovers in the park, and they actually had a Catholic priest there who did a prayer for the pigeons at this little meeting. Hmm. I couldn't believe it, but, you know, that's part of the Lord's creations.
Right.
So he opened this little meeting with a prayer for wildlife, you know, like St. Francis.
That's right. That's
just
right.
Like St. Francis. And then they spoke about how supporting the pigeons and all that kind of stuff. But let's get back to raptors. Pigeons are not raptors. They're great prey raptors.
They're prey, right. Okay.
Yes. And maybe that's why, since they prey for raptors, maybe that's why the preacher was there teaching them another prayer or
right.
something. I don't know.
That
was
okay.
Terrible, huh?
All right. Let's talk in the little bit of time we have left about the title, because if I don't get to that, we don't want people to be hanging about how fast can a falcon dive. And actually, what's so interesting, everybody sort of knows, if you're interested in falconry or in raptors, everybody sort of knows how fast a falcon can dive. And there's a famous research done by a guy who was a falconer, who jumped out of a plane with his falcon so that he could time it. And also fighter pilots have timed them. And they find that they dive close to about 200 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
The skydiving Canadian falconer who jumped out of the plane actually clocked his falcon at 242 miles an hour. Although peregrines probably don't routinely dive at such high speeds, but they are able to do that, which is amazing.
Yes, that's fast as a private plane flies.
Now, I have two things I want to squeeze in here quickly.
Sure.
One is that these kinds of extreme performances occur in situations that have important fitness consequences, right? So either an attack on elusive prey, or escape, or courtship displays.
Mm.
After we wrote this, I don't think we got it in the book. Somebody timed using video the courtship dive of a type of hummingbird. And they found that these little hummingbirds actually, in their courtship dive, for a fraction of a second, dive at a faster speed than the falcon.
Mm.
So
mm.
I always think that when I say how fast does the falcon dive, I have to give the hummingbird credit that, based on its tiny body length,
right?
When they figure the mileage, looking at the video, they actually, for that brief instant in the courtship dive faster than the falcon. So that's one aside. The other association I have with the diving is the story of the turbicle. Which I will tell you what it is. When they dive so fast, the rush of wind is enormous, of course, and it could dry up their eyes, and they have their vision is tremendously important because they're diving at a bird or at some prey, a small prey. And so to minimize the danger, they not only have the extra eyelid that a lot of birds have, that's mm-hmm. a transparent eyelid that protects the eye, but they also have an additional secretory gland that produces a thick solution that moistens the cornea during a stoop. So
mm-hmm.
that's one thing. The other thing that they have is, and of course, the other issue is, how do they breathe at such a high speed? So we got all interested in this because they have a small cone of a bone in their nose that's called a tubercle. T-U-B-E-R-C-L-E. I got obsessed by tubercles for a while. And go and try to find a photograph of a tubercle in a bird's nose. It's very hard to find them. We had a specimen in the museum that we were photographing with two different cameras. We finally found a wonderful photograph online on Nick Dunlop, who's a great wildlife photographer. Nick let us use it in the book. And you can see the tubercle in the book. Now, it just looks like a little dot in the nostril. It really doesn't look like a big deal. But I can tell you, this became an enormous deal as we worked on the book, because it's like the cone in a jet engine. And I had a wonderful photograph of a jet engine with the cone. And in the jet engine, that baffles the air, right? That's the purpose of it. It breaks up the airflow into the engine. The cone points out of the opening where the air rushes into the engine,
right,
and it breaks up the airflow. So it seems reasonable to me that the purpose of the tubercle in the nose of the falcon also is to break up the air so that they can breathe easier. It's in the nostril, actually. You're supposed to say nostril and nares.
Yes.
However,
just 1 minute. You used the word stoop before. You want to tell people that stoop means the dive?
The high-speed dive.
The high-speed dive of the bird, right.
So they're zooming down like a jet engine. They have this thick fluid keeping their eyes moist, and they have this tubercle in their nose so that they can breathe, I think. However, the problem is that there are some other birds that have that tubercle, such as the Savannah hawk in South America, who do not dive at such high speeds. And some birds that are high-speed flyers, like eagles, don't have a tubercle. So I'm not happy about this, because I really like this idea of it being like the cone in a jet engine. There's no real experimental evidence as to the tubercle's function, although Tom Cade, who's a famous falconer, says in his book, Falcons of the World, he suggests that it may be related somehow to the sense of smell, or may be sensitive to changes in pressure or temperature in relation to airspeed.
That could be it, too.
I'm really interested in this. This is a terrific research topic for somebody out there who's working on a dissertation or studying biology.
Well, Carol, what do you have, one PhD, Carol?
Only one.
Oh, well, here's a great topic.
I'm a little busy.
You're a little busy, I know that. Okay, I don't know about that thing, because I think in the jet plane, the nose cone, not Cohen, that's my relatives, nose cone may direct the air. It may even speed up the air. I don't really know what it does. So we'd have to call up, Lockheed or somebody who makes jet planes and find out.
Believe me, I have done this. I'm telling you, I was obsessed about this. I'm giving you the short version.
Okay. All right, so that's the end of the... is that our last segment today?
We have one more.
One more to go. Okay, so we're going to stop and take a break and have another drink of water, and we'll leave you with this serious question about the nose cone, the tubercle. That's what it's called? Tubercle.
Tubercle,
in
right.
In the nose, or the nostril of the falcon.
Right.
And then when we come back, Carol's going to talk some more about... other strategies that these birds use, and in history, we didn't get to the history of falconry at all.
We didn't get to a lot. No, we'll do falconry when Peter.
Okay,
is here.
He's an expert on that.
Right.
So
be fun.
We'll save that on the ancient sport of falconry. This is Bernie Wides back on the air with my partner, Carol Butler, my co-host, and of this great topic that we've been talking about, raptors, which are birds of prey. As Carol said, many other birds eat, living things like bugs and things like that. But raptors have evolved as specialists and to do this. And we mentioned Velociraptor, which was an antecedent. Is that the right word?
Yep. Yes,
antecedent of our modern birds. And we're going to continue along now, Carol. So what do you want to talk about now? We have so much material here.
I know. I would like to talk about how long raptors live. Now, Bernie, you know a lot about birds. What I found interesting was that many or maybe most raptors die in the first year of life, even before they leave the nest, right?
Yeah, it's a tough time for them. I mean, they're defenseless there, and they have to learn how to fly.
That's right.
From a very high place. And in the Pale Male film, it shows one of the young offsprings fledging,
fledging,
and how much trouble they had. And you know, and these lived right above Fifth Avenue, and one of them fledged and ended up in the traffic on Fifth Avenue.
Fledging is when they leave the nest
time. Yes, and that's why the mortality rate is so high.
Reasons, right? Yeah. When they fledge in the forest, they often don't fly,
right?
But they land on a branch, or they even land on the ground.
That's
and
the danger.
And the parents will continue to feed them until they get the hang of flying, and so they might survive because the parents are sensitive to this learning to fly process. But of course they might get eaten while they're in the process of sitting on the ground because they can't get back up to the nest.
Right, and you know it's easier to fly if you jump off a cliff.
Right.
Because then you're out in the air already, you can flap your wings and you're ready to go. But if you're on the ground, it's much more difficult.
Right. Well, I guess they're lucky if they land on a branch,
right?
Because then they're safer. But of course, this is natural selection, right? Since more birds are produced than can possibly survive, 20-40% of nestlings probably die as a result of starvation or siblicide. That also happens with raptors.
With a lot of most birds, it happens.
Is that right?
That means if you have more than one egg in the nest, the offsprings will may kill some of their fellow offsprings.
Right, because the birds, they're not all hatched at one time.
Right, they're hatched
sequentially, and so the first bird that has hatched is bigger than the brothers and sisters, and so the larger ones may eat the smaller ones, especially if prey is scarce. The parents are bringing prey to the nest and splitting it up among the kids, and the bigger birds dominate the feeding pattern and are more aggressive, right? And so the smaller ones may starve or may be attacked if there's not enough food, because then they become prey.
Yes, in your research, have you done anything with humans? That kind of thing, or we won't go into
with
that
with humans.
Now.
You mean
human offsprings?
Well,
sibling rivalry.
Yeah, sibling. I've did something recently about intrauterine competition.
Oh yes,
remember
about, was it sharks?
Was sharks or lambs? I don't know. Some animal we talked about.
Yes, sharks. Yeah.
Let's not get too far afield.
Okay, let's go back to
raptors,
right?
So Cynthia Berger, who has a wonderful book about owls, she estimates that 50-70% of owls die before they reach 1 year old. But that's the time of highest mortality. And from the time birds fledge, leave the nest for the first time, until they reach maturity and acquire their adult plumage, the estimated mortality is as high as 90% for some species, due to the combination of things we've been talking about, starvation, predation, disease, and accidents, as Bernie mentioned. A lot of birds that end up in rehabs have had accidents. Mm-hmm. We have a photograph of an eagle. Oh, I should say the name of the rehab. This is one of the first things I found in the book. It's at Loretta James is the one who gave us at the Hawk Creek Wildlife Center. This is an eagle named Canyon that we believe was hit by an airplane or a car. It was found on a road right near an airport.
Yeah, where is this rehab center?
This is in Utah.
Oh, in Utah.
But there are a lot of them.
Yeah, all around the country.
I interviewed a lot of people who worked in rehabs, and I've written a lot about that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just see what I want to add. I have something I want to add about survival. If they survive the first year, medium-sized raptors, like the red-tailed hawk, can live 10 or 15 years, from 10 to 15 years. Large eagles, if they survive, takes them about 5 years to transition to their adult plumage. They can live 20 to 30 years in the wild, and they live much longer in captivity, which I'll add something about that if we have time. The oldest known free-living eagle was 38 years old. That was reported by an ornithologist in 2001. 1982, another person reported a banded osprey that lived for 32 years, and a golden eagle that lived 25 years, and a honey buzzard that lived 29 years.
Yes, that's
so these
a long
are
time.
In the wild, and they know that because of banding. They were able to tell, should we say, just briefly about banding.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many things to talk about. You know, banding is putting a bracelet on the raptor's foot. At the wetlands this weekend with all the hummingbird people, what they were interested in was how you band a hummingbird.
Carefully.
Because I, very carefully, because I was banding hummingbirds. I was assisting George, my co-author, George West, in banding hummingbirds out in Arizona. And we have some wonderful photographs of the banding, and I included a photograph which is not clear enough of the bands for the hummingbirds, which because that's what everybody was asking about, and you can imagine how tiny the bands must be and what that process is like. Of course, with a raptor it's easier because they're big, as long as they don't bite you.
Yeah, well, you calm them down. They, you know, they put a hood over their heads. I imagine.
You know what they call it when they calm them? There's another. We have that in the book. That they call it Madonna-ing.
Oh, like mothering.
They wrap it in a blanket when they catch a wild, like a big wild raptor. They wrap it in a blanket, put a hood on it, and hold it like a baby.
Right.
And they call it Madonna-ing. We have a photograph of a female falconer holding, Madonna-ing a big raptor. I think it's an eagle. So just to add before we run out of time, how long they live in captivity, which is because people are, I came across somebody recently who was very anti-falconry, which Peter had warned me about. But in writing this book, I was among the pro-falcon people, so I didn't really get the anti part. But there are also people who object to having animals in captivity in any setting, although raptors in captivity are almost always there because they've been injured. And if they can't, even if they can fly, because you see them in demonstrations, they'll fly,
right.
But if they can't fly really well, or if their vision is not terrific, they're not going to survive in the wild, because that's what they depend on. So if they're compromised, they won't survive, and then they make wonderful educational assets in zoos and in rehabs that go around touring and introducing people to the raptors, what they look like and what they can do. So in a zoo or an educational program, small falcons and accipiters, which is another word for hawks, have been known to live about 15 years. Medium-sized buzzards and kites can live 20 to 40 years, and large birds like vultures and eagles have been known to live for as long as 55 or 60 years in captivity.
That's a long time for a bird.
Very
right?
long time, more than double their usual maximum right. lifespan. I remember in Holland, I was at a bird sanctuary. I'm blanking on the name of it. But they had a big eagle cage, and they have it. It's up very high, and it's very long, long, big cage.
Plenty of room to fly.
Right. Yeah. But the one eagle, the male is on one side, the female's on the other side, and it's just sitting perfectly still. It was really quite a powerful image. So that's how long they live. They live a really long time if they're well taken care of. Okay. Well, to be continued when Peter is here. We'll talk a lot more about raptors, and Peter will tell he's got wonderful stories about falconry and about artificial insemination and all sorts of things that we're saving that for you.
Okay, that will be part two of this show. And what date? Do we have a date yet for that show, Carol?
We're recording on October 4th, and yes. I don't know when it'll be on the air.
Yeah, well, you know, if you if I have your email, I give you notice every week about the new show. I try to get the notice up Sunday night. Sometimes I can't, but by Monday, it'll say what the show of the week is. So we're going off the air now for the end of this show, and I can tell you now that there's so much material that we really couldn't fit it all in today. Right. And remember Carol's new book called How Fast Can a Falcon Dive has just come out, and I really recommend it.
Thank you
so
very much.
We'll see you next week with another new show, and this is Bernie Wise and Carol Butler, my co-host, signing off for today.
Thank you.